nature to be able to live a free and more prosperous life. Its examples are also different. The first generation deals with civil and political rights, the second generation is about economic, social and cultural rights, and the third generation concerns rights such as the right to development, self-determination and having a healthy environment. In fact, it's a whole unit, but at the same time, it's divided into different components.
Given how the Islamic Republic of Iran and international law seem to find themselves at odds with one another, it is easy to assume that could stem from a difference between a Western understanding of human rights and an Islamic one. Mr. Parkayin, a former ambassador of long standing, explains.
In the West, human rights are based on humanism, the originality of human beings, which became very prominent after the French Revolution. Afterwards, man replaced God. Because of the conflicts that the intellectuals had with the church at the time, they replaced God with the man, and said that it's the man who can give power to others. Therefore, the philosophy of humanism took shape, which gave birth to liberal democracy. According to principles of liberal democracy, human beings are free to do whatever they want, with no conditions whatsoever. In the divine religions, including Islam, people enjoy many rights, but there are limitations that are innate and are related to the specific nature of human beings and their inner characteristics.
The United Nations formation was primarily supposed to be to prevent wars and to protect human rights, but instead, big powers, particularly the US, use it to serve their own narrow interests. Example, America has exercised its power of veto countless times in protecting the Israeli oppression of Palestine, its illegally continued settlement building. As Hamaneh put it, the current international climate is obsessively hostile to nurturing genuine human solidarity to protect and promote the common good. Ironically, human rights are the main casualty of today's international relations. Given the international community, as we call it, is pointing a finger at Iran, what has Iran done to improve human rights matters? You must wonder what happened to our political, non-political prisoners. Iran has resolved a lot of issues, but when there's a warlike domestic atmosphere between political factions, partisanship tends to interpret everything as a security issue. Mr. Abu Torabi is on the Human Rights Committee of Parliament. He tells of how Iranian law has been amended to fit with the international expectation.
Especially now, one of the positive moves made with regards to the Constitution was the addition of political crime to it. In a recently enacted political crime, we allow a political offender to have a jury. We let the political offender, if convicted, have the right to have family visitors on a daily basis. Solitary confinement has no place anymore. We don't have solitary confinement for a political criminal. There are great achievements that most countries in the world are yet to enjoy.
In such murky waters, anyone can easily use accusation and false labels, such as spying, for instance, to gain personal advantages. In the face of foreign threats, the leader Ayatollah Khamenei has urged a unified voice among officials and people alike. Iranian authorities do not claim that Iran has been perfect in terms of human rights. That is a claim no country can make, actually. And in an effort between the three powers, laws are being amended or considered for amendment, such as laws on citizenship rights. I'll let an expert comment on that, of course.
In the Islamic Republic of Iran, the issue of individual freedom is well seen in Article 27 of the Constitution. Freedom of expression and the press within the framework of the law is well enacted, and now we see how much criticism is directed at everyone, even our country's top officials, including the leader of the Islamic Revolution. As we have seen in video clips, people who visit him easily express their opinions. The same goes for the president and government officials and members of the parliament.
Over the years, Iran has tried to improve on a variety of issues. Those include prisoners' rights, the right to prohibit torture and arbitrary detention, the right to health, to education, women's rights, children's rights, the right to freedom of expression and access to information, the right to freedom of political association, trade unions and community organizations, Also, the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and to self-determination, the right of people with disabilities, the right to adequate housing, the rights of asylum seekers and immigrants, and of religious minorities, and freedom of belief and religion.
I'm saying this confidently, that you can't find any country in the world where all minorities are required to be represented in the parliament. In Iran, we must have one Jewish lawmaker, two Christians, and one Zoroastrian parliament member, according to their population. You do not have such a thing in France right now. Most European Muslims are in France, but they do not have laws that require one or two representatives to be Muslim. Of course, if Muslims vote and participate, they can be elected. But Iran's law requires some lawmakers to be representing the Jewish, Christians, and Zoroastrians.
As for how successful these efforts have been, we can say with confidence that regardless of the outcome, there is an ongoing rigorous debate among Iranian authorities and people about how the ideals of the revolution have not yet been reached. It is understood that more work, sacrifice, and effort lies ahead to attain the exemplary standards of social justice based on the teachings of Islam and great Iranian traditions.
The right to education is also amongst these rights. It means that governments are obliged to provide the necessary facilities for citizens to have access to an appropriate education. In the same context, the right to education has been considered in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. For example, we can refer to Article 30 of the Constitution, which emphasizes free and public education. In this regard, we now see that in our development program, the issue of education has always been emphasized. For example, in the 12th part of the 6th development plan, there is again a section dedicated to public and higher education.
Human rights efforts and achievements of the Islamic Republic of Iran have mostly been commended by the international community in recent years. The UN Human Rights Council itself last year paid Iran a compliment in its periodic review of this country's human rights record. The preliminary debate on the report featured lengthy praise for the Islamic Republic. 95 out of 111 countries that took the floor lauded Iran for its human rights, according to UN Watch. That's a Geneva-based non-profit organization.
For example, I would like to say that now in the discussion related to the judiciary, one of the issues that should be considered is facilitating the possibility of people with disabilities to use judicial facilities. Now, whether the courtroom space is such that they can use it effectively, both in court and in the courtroom, facilities should be provided so that they are more accessible. In general, many measures have been taken. For example, if you look at the buildings of the judiciary, you will see that they're designed so that a person with a disability can move around easily. As for court appearances, there have been many cases where a person who had speech impediments or other problems was granted assistance to speak more easily and be able to defend themselves.
Iran's High Council for Human Rights said that the amendment of the law on the punishment of drug traffickers in 2017 had reduced the death penalty by 90%, and steps had been taken to strengthen the independence of judges, access to lawyers, and fair trial. There's plenty more to be said, but it's time to give other media outlets a chance. To see what they have to say, I invite you indoors. Here's what they actually say, beginning with Global Times. Washington ill-prepared to set human rights agenda. Now that Biden is in power, we are likely to hear strong rhetoric on human rights coming out of the White House and the State Department. We will observe multiple human rights-focused U.S. initiatives in international organizations. And we will also see new American human rights-related sanctions against Moscow and Beijing. Moreover, the reality is that Washington is ill-prepared to make a convincing case on human rights and broader democracy issues. First, America itself has not fully recovered from a deep and protracted political crisis. Many inside the U.S. still question the standards of November's presidential elections, as well as the legitimacy of information restrictions imposed on Donald Trump and his supporters by major social networks and the U.S. mainstream liberal media. The 2020 large-scale violent racial riots also question the assumption that the United States can serve today as a universal model of human rights observance. Until President Biden fixes related problems at home, his international human rights crusade will not look too credible, even for his fellow citizens. Iran's judiciary puts in a word on U.S. human rights, as pointed to in Ahlul Bayt. Iran's judiciary chief blasts U.S. human rights claims as power show. Today we see that the Americans who claim to be advocates of human rights are trampling on the rights of nations in just a show of power, Raisi said, addressing judiciary officials in Tehran. He added that the Americans attack the resistance centers in Syria and at the same time single out Iran for giving death penalty to drug traffickers as a human rights concern, noting that they extort money from the Saudis and claim that justice has been served, while they have not been seen to do justice so far. They violate the rights, trample on justice, and oppress the right-seeking people, but claim to be advocates of human rights, while the world people know them well and are no longer deceived, and know that Americans are violating the rights and are disloyal. Raisi had also earlier condemned Washington's systematic violation of Iranians' rights, and said the U.S. allies are the number one violators of human rights in the world. What does human rights mean to the West? The Global Times quotes, "Human rights used by West countries as tool of political manipulation," said the Chinese ambassador to the UN. "Certain Western countries do not truly care about Xinjiang residents' lives, but simply want to use human rights as an excuse to meddle in China's internal affairs," the Chinese foreign ministry said Thursday, urging these countries to reflect on their own slaughter of indigenous people and tackle existing racism and other human rights problems. "They should reserve the hat of genocide for themselves," ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said at a routine press conference. And that would be the news segment. Back to the narration. With a suffering economy and mismanagement, making ends meet has become backbreaking to Iranians. Albeit, China said it commends Iran's efforts to eradicate poverty, enhance social security, protect the rights of vulnerable groups, and that it hopes Iran will continue to drive economic and social development to provide a solid basis for the enjoyment of all human rights. Also, Iran's efforts to provide for refugees despite the challenges it faced and the measures to empower women, promote school enrollment, and reduce infant mortality were acknowledged.
40% of employees in Iran are women, and more than 50% of those admitted to universities are females. More than 50% of the medical staff are women. Women in Iran are employed in all jobs. We have several women in the cabinet. We had a minister. We had a vice president. We may have laws to protect families and women, but we have difficulty enforcing them. One argument says the authorities should try to implement this, but the authorities might not always have the jurisdiction. In some cases, the implementation of the laws depends on the family members.
Syria said at the debate, "We commend Iran's active efforts to increase healthcare services by building medical care in rural and urban areas." Several speakers noted that unilateral sanctions were harmful to the promotion of human rights, especially given the ongoing need to combat COVID-19. Among those recognizing the difficulties in this fight and pledging their assistance to Iran, Russia praised this country's cooperation with human rights treaty bodies and its openness for dialogue.
"We are a party to many human rights conventions, the most important of which are the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. There are two conventions in which membership brings an obligation for each country. Well, in this context, the judiciary, as one of the three branches of the country, has a duty to fulfill the obligations related to these covenants as much as possible. Our country's courts are also obliged to respect these obligations."
Developing countries are traditionally scapegoated for human rights violations. Yet, Iran became a major supporter of the Universal Periodic Review Mechanism. Hamaneh said in last year's UNHRC review session that Iran had always examined all recommendations with an open mind and a spirit of cooperation. However, certain recommendations could not be noted as they amounted to repeated allegations and biased propositions. From 1986, the UN Human Rights Council has consistently appointed a special rapporteur for Iran. But the appointment, according to Iranian officials, is not based purely on legal objectives, but on political objectives of just a few countries in the Human Rights Council.
Because international law is the product of the opinions given by all countries, it's relatively fair. But hegemonic Western countries use human rights as political tools. That is, if they have good relations with a country, if their interests are served by that country, they will not raise the issue of human rights at all. But if they want to put pressure on another country that opposes them, they will use human rights.
The Iranian Bar Association has consulted various individuals and assessed reports by the special rapporteur, Javid Rehman. Some cases had been prepared based on incorrect information and reliance on unofficial sources, and that almost all of his report was a repetition of his previous claims, which are also available on the websites of well-known opponents of the Islamic Republic of Iran who are associated with certain intelligence services. This has undermined the credibility of his report in official circles here.
Today, human rights have become a political tool in the hands of the world powers to pressure the Islamic Republic. Today, there is no such thing as democracy and ballot box in countries like Saudi Arabia. But look how they are supporting Saudi Arabia. Look how Saudi Arabia slaughtered Khashoggi with a hacksaw, but they didn't target Saudis with any punishment for it. Saudi Arabia is bombing Yemeni schools and hospitals every day in violation of all international law. They don't condemn Saudi Arabia for killing children in Yemen. That is why we say that's a double standard and that human rights have become politicized and become the political tool for the world powers.
On this matter, Ali Bagheri Kani, head of the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights, stressed that there is no expert view on the issue of human rights in the mentioned report. In every part of the report are the views of Western powers that are in conflict with the policies and approaches of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We protest the political and discriminatory abuse of human rights mechanisms, he said. In the past, overt interference in other countries' internal affairs has been used by the U.S. as a tool to maintain its hegemonic status. Now, whatever the situation in Iran, perhaps again this country's human rights record is about to be used by the Biden administration as a bargaining chip in getting to adapt rather than revive a troubled nuclear deal. To repeat, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken claims his government is committed to safeguarding human rights of all people because they're universal values. But Donald Trump was also a U.S. president till very recently, and it was he that withdrew the U.S. from the UN Human Rights Council in 2018, claiming that the council wasn't acting favorably enough towards Israel. And the Biden administration hasn't yet returned to the UNHR Council.
Consider those who sponsor human rights resolutions, such as Canada. Canada treats its natives the worst. Australia has a group called the Aboriginal people. These are indigenous people, as you probably know. In order for people to come and watch them as if they are in a museum, they still keep the Aboriginals in a state of barbarism to earn some money. They claim to be defenders of human rights. The United States is committing crimes against people of color. Look how they burned the Davidic sect and the Europe's NATO that committed so many crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Europe supports the crimes of the Israeli regime against the Palestinians. They back the child-killing regime of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
The United States faced its first review in 5 years at the UN's main human rights body with the detentions of migrant children and the killings of unarmed black people during the Trump administration's tenure, among other issues high on minds. AP reported this in November 2020. Friendlier countries called for the U.S. to ratify various treaties aimed at guaranteeing human rights, but they expressed concerns that racial inequalities and discrimination, gun violence, and the use of the death penalty in the U.S.
Look how much human rights were violated in the case of people of color due to Trump's racist actions and support for racism. This was a heavy blow to the Western culture's identity. The same goes for Europe. This is what is happening in France and the crimes committed by NATO as the flag bearer of peace in Afghanistan and Iraq. These all have raised questions about human rights in the West. Now Europe and the United States have lost their identities in this regard. The basic principles of the French Revolution have now been violated.
The American Civil Liberties Union has called the government's report one of the worst attempts to cover up U.S. human rights violations since the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century. The Chinese representative, Jiang Zhuan, cited namely systematic racism, politicization of the COVID-19 pandemic, the proliferation of guns, and military interventions abroad that left civilians dead. Stop interfering for political reasons in other countries' internal affairs under the pretext of human rights, he said.
Iran is one of the countries that has taken the best steps with regards to freedom. It has made good progress. Look at the United States recently, or even the countries that claim to be the cradle of democracy. I cite France as an example. Look how the French police treat people. They even have discussed a law that prohibits journalists from publishing interviews with people protesting in the streets. This is why our law permits this. People are free in these matters in Iran.
Earlier in February, Ayatollah Khamenei said the domineering order has always looked for excuses against the Islamic Revolution. One day it's human rights, once vilifying theocracy, once the nuclear issue, and once regional issues. They're all excuses. The key concern is that Iran won't give in to their domination. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Don't forget to return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's going to be on. And we're waiting for your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. President Joe Biden held one more giant step forward on delivering on that promise that help is on the way after Democrats took a critical step towards a first major legislative victory since assuming control of Congress and the White House, with a party-line vote in the Senate to approve a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Lauren Gambino and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Biden hails giant step as Senate passes $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino and Martin Pengelly's article. President Joe Biden held one more giant step forward on delivering on that promise that help is on the way after Democrats took a critical step towards the first major legislative victory since assuming control of Congress and the White House, with a party-line vote in the Senate to approve a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. After a marathon voting session through the night on Friday and into Saturday afternoon, 6th of March, Democrats overcame unified Republican opposition to approve the sweeping stimulus package. The final tally was 50 votes in favor, 49 votes against, with one Republican senator absent. One of the largest emergency aid packages in U.S. history now returns to the House of Representatives for final approval before being signed into law by President Biden. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has said she expects to approve the measure before 14th of March, when tens of millions of Americans risk losing unemployment benefits if no action is taken. The House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, said the Senate version of the American Rescue Plan would be considered on Tuesday so that we can send this bill to President Biden for his signature early next week. Biden and Democrats will look to move on to other priorities, including voting rights reform and an ambitious infrastructure package. The bill aimed at combating the COVID-19 pandemic and reviving the U.S. economy will provide direct payments of up to $1,400 to most Americans, extend federal unemployment benefits, rush money to state, local, and tribal governments, and allot significant funding to vaccine distribution and testing. Republicans attacked the bill as a liberal wish list, mismatched with an improving economic and public health outlook as more are vaccinated and infections plateau. Our country is already set for a roaring recovery, said Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, on Friday, 5th of March, citing a jobs report that showed 379,000 jobs added in February. Democrats inherited a tide that was already turning, Mitch McConnell said. But Democrats and the White House were quick to push back, pointing to more than 9 million Americans out of work and millions more struggling to pay their rent and for their food. On Saturday, 6th of March, with Vice President Kamala Harris looking on, President Biden spoke to reporters at the White House. "I want to thank all of the senators who worked so hard to do the right thing for the American people during this crisis and voting to pass the American Rescue Plan," he said. "It obviously wasn't easy, wasn't always pretty, but it was so desperately needed, urgently needed." Biden has been criticized for not holding a press conference since taking office. On Saturday, he attempted to leave without taking questions. To shout at questions, he avoided direct criticism of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia or Republicans. The marathon Votorama session on amendments that preceded the final vote featured the longest vote in Senate history, just shy of 12 hours, on Friday, 5th of March, as Democrats scrambled to strike a deal with Senator Joe Manchin, a moderate who mounted a last-minute push to scale back unemployment benefits. Bowing to Senator Manchin, a compromise kept benefits at $300 a week instead of $400. As proposed by President Biden and approved by the House. However, the benefits will be extended until October rather than August, and Democrats added a provision to provide up to $10,200 in tax relief for unemployed Americans. Speaking to reporters on Saturday, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer repeatedly held his caucus and deflected invitations to criticize Senator Joe Manchin, the target of anger among House progressives. "People have new differences all the time," he said, when asked why Senator Manchin had not leveled his demand earlier. Chuck Schumer added, "Unity, unity, unity. That's how we got this done." Schumer was asked if another bill might be needed. "It's a very strong bill," he said. "Part of it will depend on COVID. How long will it last? Will there be a new strain?" Experts have warned of a potential fourth surge as variants emerge and predominantly Republican states reopen their economies and abandon basic public health measures. Senator Chuck Schumer added, "Part of it will depend on the economy. It has some underlying weaknesses that need bolstering. How deep and weak are those? Our number one lodestar is going to be helping the American people, and if they need more help, we'll do another bill. If this bill is sufficient, and I think it's going to help in a big way, then we won't." At the White House, President Biden praised Chuck Schumer, When the country needed you most, you led, Chuck, and you delivered. Despite deep political polarization and staunch Republican opposition, the legislation has broad public appeal. An opinion poll by Monmouth University found that 62% of the American public approve of the stimulus package, including more than 3 in 10 Republicans. In tweets on Saturday, former President Barack Obama said, "Elections matter. This is the kind of progress that's possible when we elect leaders across government who are devoted to making people's lives better." Yet the endeavor tested the fragile alliance between progressives and moderates as Democrats attempt to wield their power with only the barest control of Congress. Early on Friday, the Senate rejected a proposal by the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders to include a $15 an hour minimum wage increase, a top liberal priority and a key plank of Joe Biden's economic agenda. The Senate parliamentarian had deemed the provision inadmissible under the rules of a special budget process Democrats are using to bypass Republican opposition. Despite widespread public support for raising the federal minimum wage, Democrats remained divided. On Friday, 5th of March, 8 joined Republicans in blocking the amendment, which would have required 60 votes to pass. "Let me be very clear, we're not giving up on this," Bernie Sanders said. "We're going to come back with vote after vote, and one way or the other, we're going to pass a $15 minimum wage. That is what the American people want, and that is what the American people need." The approval of the bill in the Senate came after hours upon hours of voting on a torrent of amendments, most offered by Republicans with the goal of forcing Democrats to take a position on measures designed to be politically troublesome. Proceedings had already been much delayed on Thursday when the Republican Ron Johnson of Wisconsin forced Senate clerks to read the 628-page bill in its entirety, a task that took nearly 11 hours. At the White House, Joe Biden quoted Bernie Sanders as he hailed the bill as progressive and delivered a familiar appeal for national and party unity, if with a shot at his predecessor, Donald Trump. "When I was elected," Biden said, "I said we're going to get the government out of the business of battling on Twitter and back in the business of delivering for the American people, of making a difference in their lives, giving everyone a fighting chance, of showing the American people that the government can work for them, and passing the American Rescue Plan. We'll do that. You know, it may sound strange, but I really want to thank the American people. Quite frankly, without the overwhelming bipartisan support of the American people, this would not have happened."
Hello everyone, a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while backing those who violate them. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized Washington and the UN for being quick to condemn the Yemenis for their retaliatory attacks rather than trying to stop the Saudi massacre of Yemeni women and children. He also argued that Washington created a military base in Syria without the permission of Damascus. He called for the withdrawal of American forces from both Syria and Iraq. The leader also blamed Washington for having the world's largest nuclear arsenal. He reminded the fact that the U.S. is the only country that has used nukes while claiming to oppose weapons of mass destruction.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran, but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.
All right, that was a report by Matthew Fireman. Let me invite our guests to this debate show. We have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, an author and researcher Daniel Jegic from Beirut. Gentlemen, good to have you both on the show. Now, let's go to Brussels. Elijah, Iran's leader criticized the United States for its hypocritical foreign policies and also distortion of facts for its own benefit. How obvious is the hypocrisy?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Actually, it's very obvious. First of all, because the Americans are for democracy in the Middle East. That was very clearly stated by Donald Trump before Biden. Secondly, we saw how the Biden administration treated Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, saying they're not after him, but they want to sanction only element that he has ordered. But therefore, there is no human rights here to talk about. And it's completely hypocrisy manifested in every single way. We see in Yemen when the Americans are asking the Yemeni to stop advancing toward Maghreb, but they're not lifting the sanctions. We see the U.S. occupying Syria and preventing the commerce to return between Iraq and Syria, and that's also another form of hypocrisy. We see the sanctions on Iran, the sanction on Venezuela. All the U.S. acts are double standards, and we are used to that. So therefore, it is just the fact that we listen to the U.S. administration just cherry-picking whatever they want, whatever they select to say this is human rights violation, or this is not human rights violation, or that we cannot sanction, or yes, we can sanction the entire population. And this game is very obvious today. It is no longer possible to achieve the population and the world who is watching how the U.S. is behaving.
Okay. Now, Daniel, Iran's leader has slammed the U.S. for creating military bases in West Asia under the pretext of fighting terrorists. You know, it's a known fact that the U.S. gave rise to terrorists like Daesh, as admitted by American officials. So what is it that Washington pursues by spending big bucks and setting up numerous military bases around the world while facing a plethora of issues back home?
Yeah, I think this question can be answered through a mixture of imperialism, dominance, coercion, and also finding ways of population control and containment, which is what the United States has effectively been doing in the region for decades. And of course, there is oil and money and capitalist interests that play a role, as well as, of course, the U.S. weapons industry that has a great market in Western Asia, which effectively also politically translates into an extraterritorial expansion of U.S. Sovereignty that is perpetuated through these expansion of military bases. And what I think Mike Pompeo at one point has called the U.S. or the American experiment. And I think also the term terrorist, as you mentioned, happens to be void of meaning and can be reinterpreted in political discourse in many different ways that suit the particular political interest of the United States in order to create consent for containing or opposing any sort of enemy or position they might encounter in Western Asia.
Exactly. Good terrorists, bad terrorists, and all that. Okay, Elijah, Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon Washington's claims of human rights and then advocating violators of human rights. He cited the murder of the Saudi dissident journalist, and you mentioned that, also the war in Yemen. In one case, Washington failed to punish the perpetrator despite evidence its own intelligence apparatus has acquired. And in the other one, it keeps selling lethal weapons to the invader to claim more innocent lives. Your take on that.
Washington doesn't want to punish anybody that is considered as an ally. What the Americans are of is protect itself from losing ground and losing its hegemony in the Middle East. This is why the Americans behave in such a way. From their point of view, they think they are defending their interest and their national security. Whatever it needs to do so, they're going to do it. All these flashy titles means nothing. The Americans are in the region because they are losing ground and because they see particularly Russia winning in Syria, Iran winning in Syria, the Syrian government is regaining control. So they think they, by saying the violation of human rights in Syria by President Assad, so we impose sanction on Assad. In fact, they're not doing it. They start with the population in Syria, Yemen, Iran, in Venezuela, everywhere. That is not a human right. So whatever they are saying today, we don't take it with a pinch of salt. We just don't believe it because they can't anymore repeat the same mantra and the same narrative because we know the Americans are agonizing in the Middle East because they are losing ground. They're still very powerful, but they're no longer in control. They are losing ground in Iraq, and we see the Iraqis are demanding they leave and they abandon the country and they are resisting. So all that is a manifestation of the U.S. by bringing out excuses to remain in the Middle East and find reasons to remain in the Middle East, but it's not going to last for very long.
Now, my next question is for Daniel. Iran has also rejected the U.S. claim that the Islamic Republic's regional presence is destabilizing. The country is saying that Iran's regional presence is non-military and also requested by those countries, contrary to the U.S. presence there. Who's playing a destabilizing role in this part of the world?
And it's rather like rhetoric on Iran's regional presence is quite interesting because Iran is eventually part of this region, and its presence in this region is natural. The people of Iran are indigenous to this region, unlike the U.S. military forces, which were stationed across Iran's borders and the region. So question of who is a destabilizing force also goes back to what intention, which factor has in this case. And the United States, as we've seen, has been supporting several non-democratic regimes in the region through direct efforts, but has also attempted to destabilize Iran through sanctions, through economic warfare, as well as through supporting extremist factors in the region, with Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime just being two examples of regimes that are having a destabilizing role in the region that are directly and indirectly funded and supported by the United States and its allies. And also here, I guess, again, military weapons and oil play a major role that perpetuates this idea of the United States that is obscuring rhetorically the destabilizing force it has in the region, at the same time, in a certain way, presenting it through a discourse on human rights and protesting on liberation and all of these things that have been coming out in the last years and decades.
Now, Elijah, in another part of his speech, Iran's leader reminds the fact that the U.S. is the only country that has used A-bombs and claimed 220,000 lives in Japan. Yet it claims to oppose the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Is this anything but duplicity?
Well, it is historical that the U.S. used a nuclear bomb against Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the Japanese were surrendering. And it is not only that. The U.S. is supporting Israel in its construction of bombs. It has a couple of hundreds of nuclear bombs in the Middle East and is protecting this information and is protecting Israel and is accepting that Israel has bombs that are nuclear bombs and preventing any other country in the Middle East from creating a balance or preventing Israel from being the only one that can use the bomb, because Israel said it. In 1973, it was about to use also its atomic bomb against the Middle Eastern country. So the Americans are actually not accusing Iran of having a nuclear bomb. They know Iran is against having a nuclear bomb. They just want to curb Iranian will, and they want to force Iran to come to the nuclear, to the discussion table. And what they are doing is they saying only us as the world policemen, we can have the nuclear bomb in the Middle East, and we can say who can have what and who cannot have it. And if we remember Iran during the Shah time, it was the Americans who brought the nuclear atomic energy program to Iran, because the Shah was a friend of Iran, a friend of the U.S. Therefore, it's only selective the countries, depending how friendly they are with the U.S., can be allowed to have what the U.S. allowed them to have.
Exactly, as they are now helping the Saudis have that. Now, Danielle, Foreign Minister Zarif has also criticized the Biden administration for following in Trump's footsteps. And one instance he cites is Washington's opposing the unfreezing of Iranian money in South Korea. Your comment on that?
I think this is a good example of the lack of difference between the Biden and the Trump administrations when it comes to Iran, as well as what has just been mentioned, the Israeli nuclear program, which is another example of that shows that the U.S. involvement in this area is structural rather than related to individual incidents. The United States is, of course, keen on keeping its power in place when it comes to Israel, facilitating its nuclear program, at the same time obscuring it and preventing Israel from accountability and impunity. The issue with the Iranian money in South Korea is another one where the Biden administration might have initially had different words, but they are results of the same rhetoric, of the same structure that effectively, again, expands the U.S. Imperialist discourse on Iran, in which it is the United States that seeks to set the any sort of agreement and has the final word and has to set conditions in order to effectively also prove that it is involved in this issue. It has sort of, again, as I mentioned before, this extraterritorial sovereignty that it actually does not have in the region.
Elijah, there are many observers who argue that the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has proved to be a failure. So what's behind the new administration's not coming to terms with this fact?
That's a very good question. Actually, what we have seen from the new Biden administration is a president that is extremely confused and hesitant. And we see that not only the Biden administration is using Trump's sanctions, half sanction on Iran, but all the administrations, starting from Jimmy Carter until today, since 1979, the U.S. imposed sanctions after sanctions against Iran,
And that was a blessing to Iran because it forced Iran to be self-sufficient and it forced Iran to rely only on itself. However, yes, the harsh sanctions prevented Iran from having hundreds of billions of dollars from the oil revenue, but it's created another positive aspect. Now, yes, the sanctions are a failure, but Biden doesn't want to look weak because he's already confused. He wants Iran to come to the table, and then he wants a simultaneous lift of sanction and compliance. It doesn't work because the Americans pulled out, and Iran is on its position, saying, you return, you lift all the sanctions, and we return to the JCPOA. If this is not going to happen, Iran is going to continue escalating by using its right to abandon the JCPOA slowly but surely. And Biden can keep himself and then hold on to his sanctions, increase them, or just keep them as he wants, and he's not going to get anywhere. He needs Iran for the stability in the Middle East, even if the stability in the Middle East is not on the table. But the JCPOA will be the beginning of a talk between Iran and the Americans, and that will spare the Americans many lives, because the allies of Iran are not going to leave the Americans alone. And if Biden administration is looking, that is walking on the step of Trump administration, the Americans will not only leave the Middle East, but they will leave extremely high number of casualties behind.
Daniel, same question for you, because we have only 1 minute and so left. Will the U.S. change course and learn from past mistakes?
I don't think that this is likely at this point, because that would necessitate a change of discourse, direction of the discourse that's currently happening, and it would necessitate, first of all, recognition that the United States has been responsible for causing a lot of hardship to Iran in the past decades, which I think is very unlikely. And effectively, as we've seen, I mean, the Biden administration is not very different from the Trump administration, especially when it comes to Iran. Biden's electoral campaign was largely based on him portraying himself as not being Trump, but effectively, the U.S. policy, any shift in its discourse on Iran, a radical one that would be needed in order to recognize these many mistakes that have been done, would at the same time destabilize the foundations of U.S. foreign policy that also is, in at least Western Asia, is very much tied to the U.S. political identity.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Thank you, my guests. We had journalist and political analyst Alicia Magner from Brussels, an author, and researcher Danielle Yegich from Beirut. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafian. I'll see you next time.